We're about to learn about using ABA to manage behavior. Join us today on Fostering the Future.
Welcome to the Fostering the Future podcast, a show about all things child welfare, dependency, adoption, and foster care. Here are your hosts, veterans in the world of child welfare, Jack and Kat.
We believe that every human has incredible and equal value regardless of what side of the courtroom we sit on. We hope that everyone feels welcome and accepted here on Fostering the Future.
Make sure you follow us on Facebook or Instagram as Fostering the Future Podcast, or check us out on our website at fosteringthefuturepodcast.org. This is Jack, and today we are speaking with Samantha Haskins. Sam is a BCBA who provides ABA services in Tampa Bay, Florida. Thank you so much, Sam, for taking the time to share with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sam, I have a very important question to ask you before we get started. What is your favorite beverage at Starbucks?
Strawberry acai with lemonade.
Is that a refresher?
Yes.
Okay. Acai. Is that what you
say?
Acai. I always say it wrong. Isn't that the stuff that people get like bowls of with like...
Yeah, Starbucks definitely doesn't put acai in there. They're getting sued right now.
Okay. Yeah. So that's what I'm like, because I thought I knew what acai was because of my experience at Starbucks. So I went to the new... Have you been in the new pub club?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and have you gotten a CA?
I've gotten it in smoothies before, and it's definitely not in the Starbucks refresher.
Right, so, like, I thought I liked a CA.
Acai.
And then I went to Publix, and they were like, oh, yeah, look at all these toppings. You can get, like, granola and bananas and all this stuff in there.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, cool. So I tried it, and I was like, I love this top stuff, like, you know, the bananas and the granola and like the stuff. But then you get down to the acai, and I'm like, it's like frozen, like...
It's gross.
It's like frozen, I don't know, it's like sour sweet. It's not great. It's like sherbet, sorbet or sherbet,
whatever,
like however you say it, yeah.
They're actually getting sued because I think the strawberry acai one doesn't have acai.
The CI. I'm totally thrown off by that because I thought I knew what it was and clearly I don't. So I'm not ordering that anymore.
Yeah, right.
Have you tried any of the new boba type drinks?
So I've only tried the blue one, the blue raspberry one.
Yeah, that's the only one they have right now.
The coconut one tastes okay.
The drink.
Yeah, with the coconut milk. The lemonade one tasted awful.
Sam, can you tell us why you decided to enter the world of ABA?
When I was young, I always wanted to be like a pediatrician or to work with like kids. Then I found out that being a pediatrician is a lot of school that I didn't want to do.
I mean, so is being an ABA.
It is a lot of school. It's a little bit less though. But growing up, I would always have children with special needs come up to me. And so I was like, oh, this would be a really cool road to go. So I started doing school to be a teacher, to be a special education teacher. And I started substitute teaching in Pinellas County. And the general education classrooms I did not like. So I switched to the special needs classrooms and I loved it. And I had teachers calling me saying they wanted me back, and I was like, okay, this is for me. But then I realized that when you're a special education teacher, I feel like you're not as involved in the kids' lives as you are with ABA.
Yeah, definitely.
So then I found ABA actually through a practicum in school that I had to do.
Can you tell us what a BCBA is?
Yeah, so it stands for Board Certified Behavior Analyst. I got my bachelor's in psychology with a minor in applied behavior analysis, which is ABA. And then I did my master's in ABA, both at USF.
So you're a bull is what you're saying.
Go Bulls. So I started with one company and I became a registered behavior technician, which is like the bottom of the pole in ABA. And then after a year of being a registered behavior technician, I went to BCABA, which stands for Board Certified Assistant Behavior Analyst. And then I jumped to BCBA 2 years after that. So I've been doing this since 2020. right when the pandemic hit.
Oh, gosh. That's an interesting time to start working, especially with kids.
Yeah, definitely. Like,
did you have to do it virtual initially?
No. So that one agency, I stayed with them until I became a BCBA. And then after about 5 months after, I changed to my new company that I'm currently at. But what we did to limit exposure was we could only go to 2 houses at most. Each client only had 1 or 2 behavior therapists, and they could only go to 1 or 2 houses.
So you were in the bubble.
Yeah, you're in the bubble. But at least I still got out and got to work, and we were technically counted as essential workers.
Yeah.
So I really liked that, because I can only imagine how hard it was for everybody to stay home.
Yeah.
All the time.
With 10 kids. No toilet paper.
At least we were busy. Oh, no toilet paper. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, they don't consider families of 10 or 12 when...
Important.
Mm-hmm. When they're saying you can only have 2 rolls of toilet paper at a time, so... That was fun. Sam, can you tell us in 1 sentence what ABA is?
So ABA is an applied science that essentially uses environments and different variables to change behaviors.
I think you're the first person who actually got it in 1 sentence.
Yeah,
because I've asked a couple of people that question now, and it's like, that is a run-on if I ever heard it.
It's hard. It's hard. There's a lot more to it. So,
yeah, well, speaking of a lot more to it, can you explain a little bit about the science behind how ABA works?
Yeah, so we study basically environmental variables to see what is causing the behavior. Because first and foremost, every behavior is some type of form of communication. So for instance, if a child is hitting you, that typically means they want something and they're not able to communicate it to you. So we sit down and we take what we call ABC data, which is antecedent behavior consequence, and we figure out what is the cause of this behavior. What do they need that they're not able to express?
Yeah. So you use data to figure out what it is they're trying to communicate. Like, hypothetically, if a kid had, like, beat the tar out of me earlier today and, you know, just walked in and was like, you know, I don't want to do that one thing you asked me that's, like, really not a big deal, and just starts, like, throwing things. Later, we come to find out that that child maybe was hungry. But maybe, like, how do you know that child hypothetically would have told me he was hungry and told you that he didn't want to go back out to get his bag from the car because it was warm? How do you know which one it was?
I think the child could be confused as well. When we're looking at children with developmental disabilities, their memories are a little bit lagging. And they also, it's hard for them to tell you what they want. So it might have been because he was hungry, but it could have been because it was too hot outside. And it just could have been that he just didn't want to do it. But instead of asking you, like, hey, can I have a few minutes? Can I eat a snack first? It's, let me do this problem behavior because I don't know the words that I need to say to you.
Looking at the science of how you determine what the possible triggers for it were, how does that get fixed?
Yeah, so there's different interventions, right? So what we do after we find out, like, what we call is the function of the behavior, right? So it could be, we have 4 different functions, and it's escape, social, tangible, and then you have an automatic function, which is, like, sensory. So once you figure out the function, then you can apply the appropriate intervention. So that intervention, for instance, he needs a lot of functional communication training is what we call it. So you would teach them, hey, just communicate to me what you want and give him the words, because he may not have the words in the moment. So you kind of want to interrupt it. You want to look at that antecedent, what's happening, like the precursor to his behavior, and then see if you can stop it.
Do you always do that after, or is there a way to do it during? When a child's having a meltdown, it feels like anything you could say or ask them doesn't really make a difference until they're calmed down. So is there a way to preempt that in the middle of it, or is it always something you address later?
So teaching doesn't occur in the middle of tantrums or high intensity behaviors because, you know, I get mad. And if you tell me something in the middle of me being really mad, I'm going to not hear anything you're saying. I'm just focused on being mad. So essentially, if you're able to stop it before it gets to that point, so instead say, hey, give him options, right? You can notice that he's annoyed by that response or that demand of you telling him. You can say, hey, do you want to wait 5 minutes? Do you want a snack before? And give him options and then try that. But then if not, say we're a full-blown tantrum, you wait for calmness and then you would prompt that.
Okay.
So you would prompt whatever functional communication. Do you need a snack? Do you need this? Talk to me. But then you would still follow through on the demand, whatever the demand was.
So hypothetically, if the mom like sent another kid out to get his bag, they would have totally failed that lesson.
Not failed. You know, it's a work in progress. Parents are so used to doing things one way or another, right? You've been doing certain things for so long. And then to have someone come in and say, hey, you're actually supposed to do this. It's a huge learning curve.
But obviously what we were doing wasn't working or, you know, you wouldn't be here.
Sure. Yeah.
You had mentioned that there were a number of
functions. Yeah.
Okay. Can you explain those to us?
Yeah. So the functions of behaviors are essentially why is this behavior happening? So typically there are four different functions. There are more being researched right now. Cool thing about ABA is it's an ever-growing field.
Now, are these things for all kids or just kids with special needs?
It can be all kids. Right. It applies to all kids, honestly. But typically we do mostly use it for special needs. So you have attention. So a child could engage in a behavior because they want attention. And that can be negative attention, reprimands, yelling at you. Attention is attention to a child. And it can be positive, like, oh, good job, honey. And then you have escape. So that's essentially, I don't want to do the thing you're telling me to do, so I want to go away. And then you have access to tangible, which is they want an item. They're displaying this behavior because they want something. It can be food, it can be tablets, it can be anything. And then you have automatic, which is what we call sensory. So it's not socially reinforced.
What do you mean by socially reinforced?
Oh, from another person. Okay. So, like, attention typically has to always be from another person, right? You want the attention from mom. Yeah. So I'm going to do XYZ because mom's going to talk to me. So you can't give someone a sensory reinforcement. I can't give someone sensory reinforcement. So, for instance, if a child engages in self-injurious behavior, they're banging their head on the wall. There's a sensation in their head that they want to get from that behavior. That's the hardest behaviors, too.
So we have escape. We have
access to tangibles.
Access to tangible, attention seeking, and then you have automatic. Those are the four. As far as the science behind ABA is you're identifying what the antecedent is and you're training to handle that antecedent in a different way.
Yeah, we want to replace the problem behavior. So instead of engaging in this maladaptive behavior, we want you to communicate or for sensory behaviors, do something other than banging your head, which could be like you have a kid who wears like a helmet, like that pressure and that sensory to replace it with something more functional and more safe for the kid.
What's safer than a helmet?
That is safe. That's perfect. Safe. But the school systems will not let you wear it. So it's not allowed in the schools.
That's going to be a problem.
Yep.
Who is ABA appropriate for?
Essentially, it is aimed for people with like developmental disabilities. So they have a hard time expressing, like communicating. They have a hard time getting skills that maybe neurotypical children get more on par with.
The interesting thing is a lot of people who have children in foster care, I mean, obviously we're doing a whole series on it. These children have experienced trauma and the trauma has kind of rewired their brain to create some bad behaviors. And I know a lot of foster kiddos that don't necessarily fall into a category that insurance provides ABA for. Like sometimes foster parents actually will just pay cash to get those services for those kids because it can be an effective strategy to help with those behaviors. Obviously, if we're talking about behaviors, why wouldn't the first line of defense be a modality that is specifically created to address behaviors? I think it's pretty well known that it could be an effective modality for a wide range of reasons that kids have behaviors,
sure,
including trauma-induced behaviors. So is the reason that that's not more commonly used for kids who've experienced trauma just because insurance doesn't fund it?
Yes, essentially. So insurance is very nitpicky with us, especially government insurance. There's only so many even developmental disabilities that some insurances do it for. So some insurances don't even cover Down syndrome kids. And then you have some insurance who will provide services for like ADHD kids and then other insurances that are like, no, you don't need ABA. So essentially, yeah.
I've never had a service or a therapy or anything like that that was so challenging to acquire insurance coverage for. Why is that?
Well, one, ABA does have an abusive history, so it's taken us a lot to get here, and we always have to factor that into everything. But also back, I think 10 years ago, Miami had a big, like, fraud where they were basically not going to people's houses and not providing services, but billing the insurance for it. So I think that's a huge thing. Other states, it's a little bit easier, whereas Florida, it's not as easy to get approved.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's definitely a case by state, because I have friends who live in BCBAs that live in other states, and their reimbursement rates are easy. They get treatment plans approved like this. Florida, because of that whole Miami thing, it really threw it off.
The heck, Miami? Get your act together. How long does a child generally need ABA for?
It is a spectrum, you know. If I had to guess, I would say at least 3 years.
Yeah.
And depending, you know, if you're on that further needing help and skills and just a little bit more delayed, even longer. It is best if you can get that early intervention, which I believe is about 18 months. So if you do get in earlier, you'll have better outcomes too.
Considering that, what is the process generally like? There's a good portion of time that's focused on paperwork and evaluations and all of that. As a parent, it takes a really long time sometimes to figure out, like, what is going on with your kid and what it is they need. I know with one of my kids, it was like from age one, we knew there was stuff going on and we didn't know exactly what it was. And it wasn't until he was 6 years old that he started ABA services because... You know, it took so long. That's not an uncommon thing. Like, all of my friends that I know that have kiddos with special needs, it's like years of going to specialists to figure out exactly what it is you're looking at. And then after years of waiting to figure out the best course of action, then you've spent like 2, 3, sometimes 4 years just to get to the point. And now you start it with the evaluation process and it's like months before that even starts. But then, of course, you've got to figure out which ABA provider to go to, and half of them don't call you back.
Some ABA have like huge wait lists too, which really sucks.
Yes.
On top of, you know, you just finally went through all this and then now it's like, oh, we have like a year wait list.
Start me back with the evaluation. Like, what is the evaluation looking for and kind of where does it go from there?
So the evaluation. So typically once we get you in, we reach out to you, we're like, hey, when would be a good day? Gonna do an observation. And then you kind of just go in there and you want to talk to the parent. You want to get to know the kid through the parent, because a lot of kids are gonna have what we call reactivity. So a different person's there, so they're not gonna show their behaviors.
100%.
They're not gonna show their behaviors. So these kids are gonna look like, you know, these perfect angels. And insurance doesn't want to see perfect angels. They're not gonna give you that. So we also ask that the parents, like, you kind of just like, after we talk to you and we do this parent interview and we get the backstory on the kids and your family and this and everything that, like, we really need to know to, like, what's going to best fit your family. We want to do that observation, but we kind of want you to pretend like we're not there, because the kids are going to just act perfect. Like, oh, look at that person over there. Oh, wow, she's here.
Like, my kid waits till you leave and then he starts throwing everything.
So, and then we pick an assessment. So I typically pick the assessment, obviously, after the first visit. There's so many different assessments now. You have like the VBMAP, which is verbal behavior. And essentially that one is for 0 to 4 years old. And it's compiled a whole list of like what your kid should have made 0 to 12 months, and then 12 to 36 months, and then 36 to 48 months. And those are what they've compiled from neurotypical kids and said, these are the milestones they should be hitting. So then we do the test to see, does he have this? Does she have this? Are we doing this right? And then we're also taking all that data on like the behaviors and trying to figure out what is the function of these behaviors. So there's a lot that goes into it. And then after we do the observations, we start writing the plan. And then once the plan is written, you typically go over it with the parent. And then if they're good with it, you send it in.
And then that's when insurance is going to spend 3 to 6 months trying to decide. Like, I always like when the insurance company is like, we're not going to cover this medicine. Like, you think you know more than my doctor who, like, sees me? Like, what is that? So, like, it's just, like, this is an expert in the field, but you guys are going to, like, take your time and figure out whether you agree with them or not. Like, yes. Why are you even, like, what are you just coming to?
Literally. Like, and that's the thing. So one of my kids actually got denied completely. And we had to go to a Medicaid hearing and everything. And mom's like, I'm going to fight this. And we did. And ultimately, she went into the courtroom and was like, why don't you come and watch my kid? She's like, you're just reading a paper. And she's like, that's fine. Like, the BCBA has put a lot of information, but please come tell my kid that she doesn't need the 30 hours of ABA.
Yeah.
And then once you see her,
she needs Ring cameras. Like, yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, they don't care. They will say, well, that wasn't put in the plan. Like, you're missing a comma, so.
So please tell me that after the hearing, she got service for her kid.
So what happened was it was a previous company.
Yeah.
And so we also have found out, essentially, too, if you're not making progress ethically, you're supposed to discontinue services. So she wasn't making progress at this company, so it kind of made sense. But she was making progress. It was like a 50-50, but then she switched companies, and it was like a whole clean slate with insurance.
But I understand that they want to see progress because, like, what are we paying for if it's not getting better?
Yeah.
But you also have to understand, as kids age, they're going to have more things pop up,
variable, right? Yeah, right.
The things you were working on could get better. Like, that doesn't mean that other things aren't going to happen, that
new things, like, pop up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, so once you get your approval, presuming you get approval, once you get approval from the insurance company, what happens next?
Yeah, so then the BCBA starts going, and then we try to find an RBT, registered behavior technician, that will mesh well with the client. Because you really want to have the greatest relationship with that client, or they're not going to respect you. It's just not going to be a good environment for learning for them.
Yeah.
So you want to pick the good client, and then you want to take your time and pair with them. That's one of the most important. You build that rapport with them. You build that trust. They like you. So you're a reinforcer in itself, which is amazing. Then you start getting the nitty gritty.
So then you have the BCBA and the RBT visiting the kid, however many hours the plan calls for. So I had a previous ABA company where the woman was like, if you're not getting 20 to 25 plus hours a week on ABA, it'll never make any progress, because just a little bit of time, you have to spend a lot of time with a kid for a modality like this to work. Is that accurate?
Every kid's different, right?
Right.
You could have a young kid who's like non-vocal, and so they're going to require a lot, because we're going to have to train them to do sign language, or we're going to have to do an AAC device, which is an augmentative communication device, which is like a tablet typically. They're going to probably require that 30 to 40 hours. And then on top of that, they're going to have behaviors.
Right.
So you're working through the behaviors and you're trying to teach a new skill, whereas you can have a kid who may just have some social deficit, where 2 to 4 hours a week might be okay for them.
So 2 to 4 hours a week up until 40 hours a week is basically the range.
Yeah.
And then you have evaluations how often?
Every 6 months.
And the BCBA can only spend a certain number of hours, right? And then the RBT spends a good portion of hours.
Yeah.
And that happens every week. And then you have evaluations every 6 months. And then hopefully you're seeing progress. And then whether it's in 3 years or 1 year or 20 years, eventually
they will graduate. Yes. Yes.
So what are some warning signs that caregivers could look out for in their kids that might be something that ABA would be helpful to resolve?
I think the biggest thing would be, you know, behaviors that aren't typical for that age group. So one of the main things we have to do before dealing with behaviors is we have to rule out anything medical. And I think that kind of coincides with trauma related, because I think we can do ABA, but I think at the same time, you need still some type of mental health counseling. I've always recommended, and most of the kids that I've worked with in foster care have been doing mental health counseling or some type of cognitive behavioral in conjunction with ABA. So we like to collaborate. So we collaborate with occupational therapists, physical therapists, mental health counselors, teachers. We like to collaborate so everybody's on the same page. Hey, what are you doing that I can do as well? What am I doing that you can do as well? So then it's like a united front, all trying to make
attack this child.
Make the kid's life better.
One of the two. Attack the child, make their life better, you know.
But I think that's very important, especially in the trauma lives, is having this consistent stability that, like, hey, when I talk to Miss Sam, what it's going to be. And when I talk to mom, I know what it's going to be. Because I think a lot of those kids are not used to stability,
right,
and consistency.
Can you tell us why you think ABA could be an effective treatment, particularly for children with trauma behaviors?
we are able to teach them how to communicate what they effectively want and need. And again, we're going back to collaborating with the mental health counselors, because I do think that's like super important, because that's not what we are. We're not mental health counselors. We're allowed to sit there and listen to you and like work through different problems with you. But I think it can teach them how to effectively talk to mom and talk to this person and do this. And then also de-escalation techniques like calming down and what you should do. And we also teach different behaviors of like self-management, which self-management is basically they can track their own behaviors.
I guess what I'm getting is that a very big part of ABA is to make communication happen when it's not happening. So if a behavior is a communication of a need, just like a child who maybe is on the spectrum is unable to communicate their need, when kids have experienced trauma and they go into one of these trauma responses, like often it's like freeze, fight, flight, freeze, fawn. A lot of the time they're unable to communicate what it is they need or want or what they're feeling because of those trauma responses. So actually, ABA sounds like it would be just as appropriate for children who've experienced trauma, because their behaviors are happening because of their trauma responses, which are preventing them from being able to communicate their needs.
Absolutely.
So that's really interesting. We need to talk to the insurance companies. We have been talking about how trauma can alter the way our brain and body and nervous system work, and that these changes often result in undesirable behaviors in children who experience them. And so a couple episodes ago, we talked about how the brain is essentially wired a certain way when you've experienced trauma, and these like pathways are dug in and make it really hard to go outside of these neural pathways. It affects like various regions of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex, which is that decision-making, the management piece of all of the other parts of the brain. And physiologically, a child who's experienced trauma, their brain has changed physically in a way that is causing these behaviors to happen and making it really hard for them to function in a healthy and, quote, normal way. How could ABA help to rewire the brain?
So we do a lot of repetitions. That's a big thing in learning skills, just repeating the same things over and over until it just is ingrained in your head.
So basically digging new neural pathways over and over.
But also, so my practicum I did when I was in my bachelor's, I actually followed an OT. I shadowed an OT, and she was explaining to me that like OT is supposed to either connect or reconnect those different neural pathways. So I think it also would be great to collaborate with OTs, which I really like to do, to see what I can do. Because also, you have to remember, OTs are what, maybe once a week for an hour? Whereas
we
like
get twice.
Yeah, maybe you're lucky. But typically it's 1 hour a week, and then some ABA, you can have 40 hours a week. Why don't we work with that OT? Why don't we work with that speech? Because like we can be working on those same things too, and we have so much more time.
Yeah.
So that we can just get this kid, you know.
That's awesome.
Up the milestone ladder.
That's really cool. One of the things that I had learned very early into becoming a foster parent, my very first case, I was so lucky. My very first case, I was assigned to a safe babies program. It was done in Judge Tepper's courtroom because she's awesome and she did great with the safe babies program. And you have like all of these people built into the case to kind of assist, right? You have a child parent psychotherapist. So she worked with me and the bio mom and the kids and kind of got us all on the same page. And she was really great. We saw like tremendous change in these kiddos like very quickly. But I learned so much from her. The boy would have these things where he would bang his head. I didn't know what to do because I didn't want him to hurt himself. But I didn't want to like restrain it. Like, what do you do, right? This therapist would, I think she took her cat and like showed me a way to rock her cat and had me like replicate it with him in this rhythmic movement, which is probably bilaterals, which we're learning from Z. It's all coming together. Okay. The girl at dinner would be sitting there eating dinner at night, almost every night, and everything was fine. And then all of a sudden she would just start screaming and throwing things. So the therapist had explained to me what probably happened. She's probably replaying something that happened in her past. And I'm like, okay, well, how to get it to stop? Like, she's breaking things. She's hurting people. Like, how do we stop this? What she explained to me is like, for every one time that a child has experienced something, maybe the wrong way, they have to experience it like 100 times the right way before they can fix that.
Yeah.
Right. So that was like the core thing. One of the first things that I learned about helping kids with trauma is you have to give them a safe, healthy, happy dinner 100 times before she can let go of the one bad time. Right. So what you're saying is that repetition of behaviors or repetition of patterns or habits or what have you kind of feeds right into that. Yeah. So they should start giving ABA to kids from trauma more than they should. They're like, they should be doubling the hours that kids with
I agree.
Disabilities get.
I mean, I think I think it should just be based on whatever the BCBA recommends. Like, hey, they need 40 hours. Hey, they only need 10.
ABA is a little bit controversial, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's not avoid the elephant in the room. When ABA was first suggested to me as a modality for one of my kids to use, I had no idea what it was initially.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, like, what is this? And they were just like, oh, you know, it's just this a specific type of service that really they just give to kids like this and da 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 da. I started talking to a lot of people and it was very interesting how I didn't understand how a modality like ABA was making people so emotional one way or the other. But I didn't understand about the history of it being
abusive, for sure. Right. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that history? Because that's not something that I really know a lot about.
Back in like the 60s, 70s, you had a special needs school. So if you were diagnosed with it, what they used to use was mental retardation. And then you also had like Down syndrome and just a bunch of different disabilities that they weren't really sure what to do. You got institutionalized. Back then, science wasn't like monitored, or there wasn't like an ethics code to it per se. The scientists, we'll call them scientists, would perform awful, awful experiments, including shock therapy. Punishment is what we'll call it, where you slap rubber bands, you hit them, you do all these things. So essentially, they were just doing these very inhumane things. And like they, just to get these behaviors or just to get them to do something. So, you know, you have that bad experience. And then also, I think as any ABA provider should do, is you should also look into individualized experiences. So there's a lot of adults with disabilities and they've came out and shared their stories. And I would say these adults are like 30, 20s, 30s, 40s, maybe. So basically like early 2000s, late 90s. And they'll say like, it was abusive. So a lot of ABA will focus on like this eye contact. I did a lot of research before I became a BCBA and I found that they think eye contact, it like internally feels so uncomfortable. And I'm like, okay, if it feels so uncomfortable, why is it such a big deal? But like they had previously, like they would force them, they'd be like, stare at my eyes, stare at my eyes. And then you have some adults now that like make uncomfortable eye contact because it was so ingrained in their head, you know, over and over and over.
Oh my God.
And that's not fair. Like, because I know it's still uncomfortable for that person, and then now the other person's uncomfortable. We have positive reinforcement, negative punishment, and positive punishment. So essentially, you need to start at positive reinforcement. So everything should start at positive reinforcement, and then you work your way down if you need to work your way down. Some people will just jump straight into positive punishment, and that could be spraying apple cider vinegar in someone's mouth. It could be...
Wait, they do that?
Yeah.
Or they used to do that in the 60s?
So some people still do. It's a very severe behavior. So you're going to have that very small group, in my opinion, small at least in my experience,
right,
where kids and adults may need positive punishment, but that's going to be for extreme behaviors that are very detrimental to the safety of themselves or others. I've never had to use it, so I'm very thankful. I'm hoping I don't have to.
I mean, it just feels counterintuitive. It's very interesting that you bring up the eyes, because that's actually a conversation we had. The episode's coming out tomorrow for TBRI. What she spoke about is basically how uncomfortable it is for kids who've had a trauma, or like obviously that includes kids with special needs as well, to look someone in the eye. Instead of it being about respect, instead of about it being like, I'm giving you a look and you better fix your behavior.
Yeah.
It's about like, I love you and you're safe.
Yeah. I have a lot of kids who enjoy making eye contact and they kind of use it as a sign of affection too.
Yeah.
Like, I want to interact with you, so I'm going to, like, look at you.
That's funny. I think Minnie Jack is, like, she will literally, like, push people out of the way and, like, climb in your lap, my lap, like, to get, like, your face in her face. Like, definitely. Whereas Itty Bitty Jack, we used to do this game where you would look at him and he would look the other way and, like, someone else would pop up on that side. Like, he
avoided it.
used to hate eye contact. Like, it's interesting that is something that people feel like needs to be forced so much. If it's creating more discomfort, like, do we really care about a kid looking at you straight in the face as long as they're paying attention to what you're saying? And
right.
And there's ways that you could do that. Like with
so many other ways.
With TBRI, it's like you could just like kind of touch their face yep. gently. It'll naturally have them move towards you.
Yeah.
Speaking of TBRI, I did not understand about the abusive history of ABA. What I was told basically is like, you just have to be really careful about your providers and that there's a tendency to just be really aggressive and forceful, maybe a short-term fix rather than a long-term,
yeah.
because you might be able to fix its behavior, but you're not going to help them with like the big picture stuff of like things that will adapt to other behaviors, right? What I have found is that a lot of the concepts that I've learned about in TBRI, I've seen, especially with your interaction with my kiddos, like I feel sometimes like you do more TBRI than ABA, but I feel like the ABA is happening behind the scenes in like this magical way. Have you ever learned about TBRI?
I actually haven't. So you told me about it last night and I kind of Googled it really quickly. It sounded similar to what I do. And I think that kind of goes into like every kid's different, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like in those foster homes or in the homes where you know the child has like a history, you have to like be so different.
Yeah.
Whereas with another kid, sometimes you can see like the behavior is so clear cut and dry and like you act one way with that kid. More ABA needs to have this thought and factor in feelings. A lot of ABA hates factoring in feelings. They're like, we're just environmental and this behavior is happening because of this. And I don't think that's always true.
Yeah.
I think kids get sad and sometimes they just need a hug. They're not yeah. just crying for no reason. They're crying because they're sad.
I think if I knew more about ABA, I might never have ventured into it. Because the way I feel about my kiddo that gets ABA is when he doesn't feel safe, everything is worse.
Yeah.
When he doesn't feel like safe, loved and protected, I'm having trauma right now because I'm reliving like these moments in his life where I felt like I could feel his fear or him feeling like, gosh, that like he had disappointed you or that you were upset. And it was like devastating. So for me, I think if I had known more about it before, I probably would have just been scared to start him on it because I would have felt like this is not going to work for him. He's like, yeah. it's going to make everything worse. And with our first ABA provider, I feel like that's what happened. And what they would tell me is like, it's going to get worse before it gets better. This is how we fix it. And we just have to get through it and we have to be tough. But the thing that really got me in the end where I was like, okay, I'm not doing this, was when he was having meltdowns. And what I've always done is I hold him and I pat his back. And if he starts like throwing things or hitting, I'll just like hold his arms, right? But not like in an aggressive way, in a hug, like
yeah.
facing towards me. They were like, well, he's just getting attention for you. He's doing this for the attention. And I don't really think that's true. I don't think, maybe I'm totally wrong, but I don't think I might not even be like anywhere nearby and he'll have meltdowns for things, right? And you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't.
Every kid's different. And
yeah.
I feel like everyone, we love to jump and say everything's attention-based, and I don't think that's true. And a lot of the case, kids are trying to escape something.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you can offer that hug, have them help them calm down their body, give a little talk about it, and then, hey, we're still doing whatever I told you to do
yeah.
previously. And now, on top of that, like, you made a mess, we also have to pick up that mess. But you don't have to ignore them. You don't have to not give them attention. Like, they're also, it depends on the age. Like, they're little people. They're trying to figure it
yeah.
out. Little people with big emotions.
Right,
like,
and not understanding their own emotions. And, like, what they wanted me to do was, like, turn him away from me and, like, hold him in, like, a wrestling hold instead of in a hug and, like, not talk to him and not, like, obviously you don't, like, try and negotiate with you don't try and negotiate with a kid in a meltdown, but, like, it depends on what the situation is. But if he is, like, upset and I could tell he's scared, like, while I'm patting his back, I'm also saying something like, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. You're safe. Like, those are the things. They didn't want me to say anything to him. But also we had a BCBA who would, like, ghost us for, like, at least a month at a
yeah.
time. Like, if she had called me back and been like, it's okay. This is to be expected. Like, it's going to get hard before it gets better. But it always gets better at some point. But, like, can you just, like, give me some reassurance that this is working? That we're going to see progress at some point? And then I'm not putting him through this for no, and then like it would be like 4 or 5 weeks before I heard back from her, and she wouldn't ever even answer my questions. So it was like, I can't do that. Like, I can't do this to my kid and torture him without knowing that it's going to have some huge payoff. And I don't think that it necessarily would have, but, you know, anyways.
That's unethical, by the way, and you can always report them. So after, you know, since we went through all this abusiveness of ABA, we now have a very strict ethical code, and I think it's very good that we have such a strict ethical code. And parents are always to be informed at the beginning of services, like, hey, if you ever have an issue, you can reach out to the BACB, which is the Behavior Analysis Certification Board.
Well, I don't think I have that problem anymore.
Well, yeah, I know. But, you know, for anyone listening, you have that right.
Yeah, you're stuck with the same one I was. But so I think, like, the rigidity of that provider, which is not necessarily a good fit. The more I learn about TBRI and ABA, so many people look at ABA and they're like, oh, if you're doing that, you can't do this. Which, and I think TBRI kind of feels like, oh, we're contrasting theories. But I feel like there's a way that they can work together, right?
Absolutely. I think so. I think there's a way that every discipline can essentially work together to make a child's life better.
I mean, maybe if you're doing the more abusive ABA, then it wouldn't work with these other ones. But you or the other guys haven't sprayed my kiddo with any apple cider vinegar yet.
No, so. I won't do that. I won't do that. And that kind of goes back into, like, the restraints, too. Like, I feel like that should definitely be, like, a last resort. And as in last resort, I mean, we're talking severe SIB or severe aggression to, like, somebody's gonna get very hurt. I don't think that should be a first, and, like, you should always be using positive reinforcement and trying to curb the behaviors that way and changing the environment and using different antecedents. Like, I don't think that should have been. And I commend you for getting ABA again. Because I feel like a lot of parents in your position.
I mean, I'm not sure why I did. You know, like, we had the RBT that we really liked, though. And she had a good relationship with my kiddo. Not as good as he has with his current RBT. For me, the thing was that he had gone from making very, very, very minimal progress at school. So even though all of his behaviors were, like, times 20 worse than when we started ABA, at school, he had gone from, like, really doing nothing to doing a good portion of his work. We've got to start making some progress. So that's why I was like, well, ABA was helping at school, so at least
I think that's another thing, and that's what these kids are going to school, and then sometimes they'll have ABA in school, which is phenomenal if the schools let us in and we can help work on that. But then we get home and these kids don't want to sit at a table for another couple hours to do ABA. They just sat at school for more hours, and I think you'll see a lot more behaviors if you're making them do the same things they do at school. Like, that's exhausting.
We did see that because he would go to school and then he would come home, and that's what the behavior, like, they would make him sit at a chair at the desk and do, like, basically schoolwork, like, all evening. And I'm like, hard enough for this kid to sit for 5 minutes. He had to sit at school all day. Now he's going to have to do, like, it just was ending in a lot of really bad, really extreme meltdowns and vomiting and all kinds of fun stuff. So I'm glad that we don't live in that world anymore.
Me too.
That's stressful. It's making me want to throw up. Can you tell us about a specific time in your experience where you saw that ABA was able to help a child achieve success in behavior improvement and overall well-being?
Oh my gosh, yes. So back in 2020, when I was first starting as an RBT, I first worked in a foster home. They were a therapeutic foster home. We got a bunch of kids in and out, but this kid was eventually going to be parental guardianship granted to the foster mother.
PG,
I believe his history, if I remember correctly, like, he was very neglected, not physically abused, but neglected a lot of the time. So he came in with a lot of, like, hyperactivity. And then down the road, he did get diagnosed with ASD. But we started with him in February of 2020. And then you had the lockdown, which for these kids made them go a little bit more off the wall, which I don't blame them. And so we started with him. We couldn't sit at tables. We couldn't communicate things. He would elope, off 7 acres of property, run far away, calling cops constantly, extra locks on the doors, the canopy beds. We had all these things. And so then we went into COVID, and it was me and another RBT, and then we had a BCBA. And the BCBA didn't show up too much because COVID. But she did do telehealth at the time. I think within 6 months, this kid just had like a complete 180. And mind you, we were working 8 hours a day with this kid. It was 4 hours me and then 4 hours my coworker. And then the next day we would like maybe switch it up. Like he was able to communicate. We got him to go outside. And like if we couldn't have eyes on him, we'd be like, hey, where are you? And he'd scream at the top of his lungs, here I am. And so then he also could sit at desks. So then he had to be homeschooled because he was tearing apart classrooms. I mean, Tasmanian devil. They had to clear the classroom just to keep that kid in it.
Oh, because I've had kids like that.
Because it was unsafe. And so he was able to go back to school once school opened after COVID, which I think was 2020 or 2021. Something along those lines.
Yeah.
We got the eloping down and he could say, here I am. He used to also curse. He doesn't curse anymore. He was a complete like 180 in the kid. And he's still making strides. I think he should be graduated by now, but I don't think he is. That definitely, I saw like the quickest, I guess. And with ABA, you don't always see the quickest turnaround. But that was one of the quicker ones. And he maintained a lot of the skills that we taught him even 2 years after that. It was amazing.
I was Googling one night. You know what happens when you Google, especially me.
You end up with shame
cancer.
Yeah, me too.
But it was like I needed to know, like, is this going to be like his whole life?
Typical.
Like, is this ever going to end? Like, is there an age where this is going to stop? Like, it just felt like it was never going to get better. So I'm like, if this is what he's doing at this age, and this is how much he can break and destroy at this age, like, is he going to be 15 years old, like, breaking bigger things? Like, is he ever going to stop having these meltdowns? Is he ever going to be able to, like, learn how to control his aggression? And that, like, I was just terrified, and that's a scary place to be. So it's really reassuring to hear that, you know, kids can have success.
Younger teenage, 13 years old, and he was a big guy.
Yeah.
He, you know, 6'2", big. When he was a kid, a younger kid, they thought the aggression was cute, haha, funny. Now he's a 13-year-old who could be an NFL linebacker still had the same aggressive behaviors. So it's really important to try to intervene on those behaviors, especially if it's aggression or property destruction, because they will break bigger things.
Yeah.
And they will start to actually hurt you, and it's not going to be cute anymore.
I mean,
I don't think it was ever cute.
But. It's already painful at 7 years old. It was probably painful at 5 years old. And I can't imagine when he gets a little bigger and heavier, and hopefully it just doesn't happen anymore at that point. But yeah, I think that's the thing that like a lot of people who have kids on the spectrum fear the most is like what's going to happen if this does not get better before they're bigger.
Oh, and speaking of that, parents, let's just talk about parents for a second. Foster parents, biological parents, all that, is ABA can be there for up to 40 hours a week, but for the hours that we're not, the parents have to keep up with what we're teaching them.
Yes.
So that's a misconception, is us alone as practitioners are going to completely change your kid's behavior. It's not true. Because if you don't follow the same things that we're trying to implement, it's only going to work in our presence. And they're going to learn, okay, Miss Sam, this is what I have to do. Okay, Mom's back. Now I get to do whatever I want to.
Let's talk about side effects. So in my previous ABA experience, it did get a lot worse and didn't get better.
Yeah.
Is that generally something that you see in ABA? Because I haven't seen that with you guys. Maybe that's because we already got worse. Is it normal for it to get worse before it gets better because the child's going to be fighting like the changes that you're trying to make?
Essentially, yeah. And so stuff like previously with kids, what previously worked, now we're in here and we're saying that's not working anymore. And it depends on every intervention, it depends on every kid, but there's something called extinction. So that's when a behavior that was previously reinforced isn't reinforced anymore. So let's take, for example, a kid, every time he cried, you gave him a candy bar. I come in and I'm like, hey, you shouldn't give him a candy bar anymore. You should have him ask for the candy bar, whatever.
Yeah.
So now the kid is going to cry higher and for a longer period of time. And that's what we call an extinction burst. They're going to try to get you to give in at some point. And so say you do give in. That just set a new high record for that kid. So now they're like, okay, I just have to cry a little bit higher and a little bit more intense. Mom's going to give me that candy bar.
Right.
But it should get a little bit worse before it gets better. But you also shouldn't be probably going through like 6 months of awful behaviors.
Yeah.
But that also goes back to you have to take a look. Okay, is the RBT not doing it right? Is dad not doing it right? Because if everyone's on the same page and doing it at the same time, it shouldn't be that long of a distinction burst.
Why did it not happen with you guys? Is that because he already went through it? Or do you think it's because, like, he literally wants to marry you. He found a ring and he told us he wants to marry you. He's obsessed with his RBT. He gets very sad that his RBT wants to see other clients in addition to him. So obviously the pairing has worked. But do you think it's because of that aspect that he has such a trust and a respect for you and the RBT that he is more conducive to the changes?
I think we built such a great rapport with him. And, you know, I talked to you about that the first day I met with you guys. And you said, like, you told me the previous experience. And then you told me he basically really needs that, like, good relationship. And so me and the RBT really focused on, like, hey. And I told him, I was like, I want to focus on this relationship and building that rapport. And we did that. I feel like I can have him do anything. I really can. I can ask him to do many things. And then even if he does go through that problem behavior, he calms down quite quickly for me. Those behaviors have also built up, right? So he's gotten away with so many things with you and maybe different things with dad. And so now he's able to push more with you. Mm. Whereas, like, me and RBT set up that contingency, like, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
Now we just got to work on you. We got parent training.
Yeah, now you've got a 7-year-old fiance. He's so lucky. I mean, he's kind of the cutest thing ever. So he could definitely do worse. Can you give our listeners something that they can do at home that can help regulate their children's behavior that is based out of the science of ABA?
I just think you should always remember that behavior is a form of communication. And you got to get down to, like, the root cause of what they're trying to communicate.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you subscribe and follow us on social. We hope that you join us again next time and keep on fostering the future.